can't look at the rocket launch, the trophy wives of the astronauts, and I won't listen to their words, 'cause I like birds.
Welcome to Bird Calls, everybody. This is Chris Bozak, your host. We come at you every Sunday at 1 o'clock here on 1490 WGCH. We have an announcement. We're also going to be coming at you Mondays from 8 to 9. Not a new show, but they're going to repeat this show Mondays from 8 to 9 p.m. So we are good to go on Sunday from 1 to 2, and then the repeat on 8 to 9 on Monday. On Mondays. Also, archives can be found at birdcallsradio.com, of course. Birdcallsradio.com. All the archives from all past shows. We've been on for over a year now, so all the shows are up on birdcallsradio.com. Don't forget to check that out. So we got a beautiful day here. It's a nice early spring day. Of course, the big news is early migrants. The warm winter and early warm start to spring has caused a lot of our birds to head up north a little bit early. I saw water thrush the other day, Louisiana water thrush. A couple swallows are around already. And the other day I saw my first snowy egret. So we got great egrets and snowy egrets back in New England already, which is kind of early. We got today we got Marty Dickinson is with us. How you doing, Marty?
Great, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
Bob is here. He's pushing buttons, making it sound good. How you doing, Bob?
I'm just great. Thank
good.
You.
Good. I heard you on the polka show the other day. So that's a fun little show too.
I was just on a few hours ago.
Yeah, that's a good show.
Polkaing away.
Polkas on Sunday mornings. That's I know my family likes to gather in the garage and play on or listen to polkas. So it's cool. little insight into my family. I'm not sure I should have shared that or not, but anyway, that's fun. So okay, let's get back to birds here. So with the warm spring, I mentioned a couple of things that I saw. We've got a good show coming up. Joe Warren from Wild Birds Unlimited, one of the sponsors of Bird Calls Radio, is going to talk about what's going on in the backyard a little bit. He'll be on a little bit later. Also, Kevin Carlson, a renowned wildlife photographer and bird watcher, is going to be joining us a little later. And he is known for his birding by impression system of identifying birds. And if you haven't heard of that or don't know exactly what that is, well, Kevin will be on a little later to talk about that. If you have any questions for Kevin or for me or Marty, give us a call, 203-661-5051. So with the warm spring, well, first of all, Marty, have you seen anything out of the ordinary out there this week, last week, so far?
Well, not really, because I've been doing a lot of working, so I've been in the office.
Okay.
On the computer, doing a variety of things. Of course, the spring birds are back, which is really terrific.
Yeah, and, it is fun.
You know, I think some of the usual suspects are coming back, but out birding I have not been, unfortunately.
Sometimes it's tough to tear yourself away. But even
yes, it is.
As you mentioned, even if you're just sitting there at the computer, just, you know,
looking out the window, absolutely.
Open,
chickadees, robins, and, you know, the usual suspects, squirrels.
It's always fun to see our common birds here.
Absolutely.
Well, with the warm winter and mild spring so far, there's been a lot of talk of not only the birds coming back sooner than usual, but also that it's going to be a tough year for deer ticks and other kinds of insects. But deer ticks are the ones that birders have to really watch out for. And I say a bad year, it's going to be a good year if you're a deer tick because there's going to be tons of them out there. But a bad year if you're a birder because there's
or other any other adventurer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you're a hiker,
photographer,
fisherman, photographer, anyone who spends a lot of time in the woods, especially off trails, you got to be careful out there.
Yeah.
It's gained so much attention. The Associated Press recently did an article on the upcoming Lyme disease season and deer tick season. So and they have some tips. So since we're, you know, encouraging everybody to get out there birding, we may as well encourage everybody to get out there and be safe at the same time. So here's some quick tips from an Associated Press article. I'm not sure where the tips come from. Associated Press didn't mention. Okay, New York State Department of Health is where these tips come from. Wear light-colored clothing with a tight weave to spot ticks easily. So that's one. That way, if the tick is on you, then you could see it and just brush
pick it off.
Yeah, pick it or brush it off your clothes before it gets onto your skin. Wear enclosed shoes, long pants, and long sleeve shirt. Tuck pant legs into socks or boots, and shirt into pants. I guess if you're really in a real troubled spot and you really don't want to get ticks on you, I guess that would be the way to go. I've seen very few people do that, but that's certainly one way that if you really wanted to be careful, you can do that. Here's more of my method. Another tip is check clothes and any exposed skin frequently for ticks while outdoors. I'm looking, if it's spring or summer on a hot day or even fall, every 5 minutes I'm looking down at my pant legs and my sleeves and, so far, I've been lucky enough not to have Lyme disease, but I know a lot of people who have had it and know how debilitating and just what a horrendous disease it can be.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Consider using insect repellent. Stay on cleared, well-traveled trails. Walk in the center of trails. Avoid dense woods and brushy areas. That's always good advice, especially, not only for ticks but also for the environment. You're not tramping around and, some fragile vegetation. But if you do veer off trail, you can either tuck in your clothes or just check frequently. That's another. Avoid sitting directly on the ground or on stone walls. Of course, that's where ticks live. I was up in New Hampshire before I moved down to Connecticut, where ticks are really bad in Connecticut. And I was naive enough about ticks to think that they wouldn't crawl on grass and be able to get to you. I thought they were just the domain of the woods.
Yeah.
But yeah, you gotta even if you're on the grass playing with your kids or doing anything on the grass, you gotta be careful too. Or having a picnic, you always gotta be careful. Bathe or shower as soon as possible after going outdoors, preferably within 2 hours. And here's probably the most important one. If you don't do any of those other things, at least do this one. Do a final full body tick check at the end of the day. Also check children and pets and remove ticks promptly. So be careful out there, but don't let the threat of deer ticks and Lyme disease stop you from being outdoors.
Right. I might add in a couple things there. I would highly recommend if you're going to spend a lot of time out in the wilds to tuck your pants into your socks, but also a lot of people, what they do is they tape their when they tuck their pants in and then they have into their socks, they tape around the socks. So it's just one more seal to prevent the ticks by going in. And the other thing that I might suggest, you mentioned also, Chris, was that at the end of the day, definitely check, but also check after you've taken a shower also.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a significant other or someone else, also to check you to where the places are that you can't see.
That you can't see. Yeah,
absolutely.
I mentioned this before and embarrassed him, but my 8-year-old had boy had a tick in a very unfortunate place, but we found it on time and got rid of it. So you never know where they get on these ticks get on your skin, and you don't know where they're gonna end up. We're gonna get Joe Warren on the phone before too long, but I wanted to do a little look back. We like to take a look back at what birding used to be like here on Bird Calls Radio. And, sometimes I read newspaper articles from 50 years ago, and sometimes I look at old books. And this time I'm going to just take a quick look at an old book. It's a Reader's Digest book from 1969, Our Amazing World of Nature.
They have great books, those guys.
They are good. Good photography. Even back in the 60s, good photography and good writing. But this one is about robins, and it says, yet most people know very little about this beloved harbinger of spring. So is robin actually a harbinger of spring? This is an interesting fact. We'll get to that in a second. But here's an interesting fact that not a lot of people know, unless you've heard it and it stuck with you. I heard this as a kid and it always stuck with me. I'm not sure why. But it says, the American Robin is misnamed. He is actually a thrush, but his red breast reminded homesick pilgrims of the British Robin. So actually the Robin's not really a Robin. It's part of a member of the thrush family. And the article kind of concludes towards the end. It says, you know, when you watch the robins travel north, stopping in the neighborhood to run and hop in their distinctive manner, most other birds either walk or hop, not both like the robin. You may be looking for your own particular one, your own harbinger of spring. So it's kind of known now that robins are not necessarily harbingers of spring because some robins stay with us all winter. I think more the sign of spring is when you see robins on the ground pulling out worms and things like that. That's more the sign of spring than just seeing a robin, because you could see robins year-round, even here in New England. And here's a familiar sound to a lot of bird watchers, and you don't even have to be a bird watcher to hear this sound. So let's hear what the robin sounds like. That's cheer up, cheerily, cheer up, cheerily. And I think I hear this about 5 o'clock in the morning. So here's our robin. So there's your American robin, our traditional harbinger of spring, but you got to kind of take that with a little grain of salt and, you know, do that as you would. But that's a robin. I know mine wake me up about 5 o'clock in the morning.
That's about me too, and it always puts a smile on my face.
Yeah, it is good. Yeah, it actually gives you a reason to get out of bed. But you know, speaking of birds in the backyard, I think we have Joe Warren here. You here, Joe?
I am, Chris. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you, Joe? Joe joined us every week. He's he and his wife Pat own 2 Wild Birds Unlimited in Darien and also Bedford Hills, New York. So, Joe, my feeders were dead silent all winter, and now all of a sudden, this last week or two, I'm starting to see some birds back. What's going on there?
Yes, we had, as I said in the past, this will go on record as the winter that wasn't.
Yeah.
It never really got off the ground. We had that one freak storm way back in October, and then I think one other snow event during the course of the whole winter. It was very mild. As a result, the seed heads on lots and lots of flowers and wildflowers never got broken up and distributed the way they normally would in winter weather. And so the birds had lots and lots of food for them to natural food for them to eat all winter long, which kept them away from our feeders. They really weren't needing as much energy from our bird feeders as they normally would in cold weather. But now it's springtime. And finally, those seed heads have dispersed. New growth is beginning to come up, and the old growth is going by the wayside, and they spent all winter nourishing themselves off of that old growth, and now it's gone. And this is a very critical time for a lot of birds because it's nesting season. If you watch, you'll see all kinds of activity out in the backyard as they begin to look for nest sites and build new nests or refurbish old nesting sites. And so they're looking for quick sources of energy, and the easiest place to get that quick shot of energy is to come to our bird feeders. And so all of a sudden, this time of year, the activity at the bird feeder picks up dramatically.
Okay.
It's kind of exciting.
Yeah,
it's also a time when birds are migrating. And as you mentioned a few minutes ago, the robin, we think of it as a new arrival for spring, but you're absolutely correct. They've been here all winter long. They just simply haven't been out on the grass in the front yard because they've been up in the trees and bushes looking for fruits and berries. They eat the holly berries and they eat the juniper berries. And so we don't see them out in the yard the way we do in the spring and summer.
Okay. Hey, Joe, you mentioned the feeders before. Is there a certain type of seed that we should be feeding them at this time of year, or just any old seed?
No, this is a good time to, again, to look for high fat content seed. You want to put out sunflower seeds. This is also a time where people are shifting from whatever they were using all winter long to, in many cases, safflower, because the big blackbirds have come back, the grackles, mm-hmm. and the crows and ravens are back. They, in fact, do go migrate south for the winter. Although some people see them all winter long because, again, if you look at the range map for the grackle, the common grackle, we're at the very northern edge of their winter range. So we do see some throughout the course of the winter, but not the big flocks, 10, 12, 14, 16 birds in a flock that we see in the summer. And as they come back, some people will switch to safflower as their primary seed because the blackbirds don't like it. And it's a way to keep the blackbirds from hogging all the seed in your bird feeder. But otherwise, black oil sunflower, striped sunflower, we carry in the store sunflower seed with the shells taken off already, so you don't get a mess on the ground. And keep in mind, it's the shell from the sunflower seed that burns the grass under the bird feeder because it has a very high acid content, and it'll yellow up that grass pretty quickly. So switched if you're worried about keeping your grass nice and lush and green, then switch to a bird seed that has no shells on it.
Okay.
And you won't get the damage under your bird feeders.
Joe, you also probably have some packets that are like suet packets that have a lot of yummy things in them, too.
We do. We have all sorts of different suet, and we have suet nuggets. The one thing we will change in some of our formulations this time of year, both in terms of suet and in terms of seed, is to bring in products that have some calcium added to it.
Mm.
And the calcium is something that helps the birds' eggshells thicken up so that they get harder eggshells so the eggs don't crack. And so we'll look at things like calcium care suet, which is a suet product that has additional calcium in it. And some of our seed blends will have added calcium. And that helps the birds, helps their shells develop properly.
All right. Well, now that the birds are back, people are going to need more seed. I heard you had a deal going on for Bird Calls Radio.
Anybody who comes into our store, either store, either in Darien on Heights Road across from the Norton Heights Railroad Station, or in Bedford Hills up on Route 117 across from the Splash Car Wash, mention this radio program, and we will give you a free 5-pound bag of bird seed.
All right. Very good.
Cool.
Mention the show. Joe, thanks as usual.
As always, it's a pleasure to talk to you guys.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
Enjoy the rest of the day.
All right, you too.
Thanks so
much.
We'll
see you around. Big sponsor of ours. We're going to be having Kevin Carlson on right after a short break. But before we do take a break, we mentioned Wild Birds Unlimited as a sponsor. And now that we're just past our one-year mark here on Bird Calls Radio, we want to thank the rest of our sponsors, and Marty will take care of that.
Yes, we just want to make a shout-out to all the advertisers that have been just staunch advertisers that have supported us now and in the past and hopefully in the future again. And also, we certainly encourage getting new advertisers on. We're always looking for advertisers, and it's a great way of supporting Bird Calls Radio, whether you're local, regional, national, or worldwide. Specifically, Wild Birds Unlimited in Darien and Bedford Hills, New York, Outdoor Sports Center in Wilton, the Maritime Aquarium in Norwalk, Birds and Beans, Norwalk Seaport Association, Stu Leonard's, Gray's, Earth Place in Westport, Audubon Greenwich, and Norwalk Land Trust. We thank you all for supporting us, and hopefully you'll continue to do so, and we look forward to new advertisers in the future.
All right. Thank you, Marty. And as with most ventures, without sponsors, it's not going to happen. And so that's certainly the case with Bird Calls. So, check Bird Calls Radio. There's an Advertise Here button, and you could contact Marty, and she'll take care of you there. So as I mentioned, we have Kevin Carlson coming up next. We're going to learn about birding by impression and also maybe talk about some of his terrific photography a little bit. But we'll be right back with more Bird Calls here on 1490 WGCH.
Welcome to the Wild. Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, where you can turn your backyard into an unlimited oasis of natural harmony. With birdhouses, feeders, and baths, no-waste seed blends, and a great selection of garden and gift items, Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop is any nature lover's paradise. Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, in Bedford Hills, New York, and now in Darien, Connecticut.
Hi, this is Chris Bozak, inviting you to check out birdcallsradio.com. It's the official internet home of the Bird Calls Radio program, heard right here on 1490 WGCH from 1 to 2 p.m. every Sunday. Bird Calls is your weekly look at the wonderful world of wild birds with regular features and expert guests. Birdcallsradio.com supports the show with bird blog postings, show archives, a Contact Me button where you can send in questions for the show, and a special page for potential advertisers to learn how to support Bird Calls Radio. So check out birdcallsradio.com and feel free to drop me a line.
Kimry Group is a boutique media service agency helping Fortune 500 corporations, nonprofits, and local businesses in all aspects of advertising, photography, and promotions. Kimry Photo includes assignments, stock images from 1925 to 2011, consulting, permissions, photo editing and research, as well as multimedia presentations. Kimry Media creates and executes activity for advertising, digital media, and sponsorship. To succeed and show how you can make a difference and get noticed, visit KimryGroup.com. That's K-Y-M-R-Y Group.com or contact Marty Welch Dickinson at 203-846-0359.
Welcome back to Bird Calls, everybody. This is Chris Bozak, your host. We're here with Marty and Bob are here as well, and we're going to bring on Kevin Carlson in just a minute. Kevin's a renowned wildlife photographer and birder. He's going to tell us all about birding by impression. We closed out the last segment by thanking our sponsors, but also want to thank the terrific guests we've had throughout the year. We've had a guest pretty much every week, and want to thank them for their time and effort in supporting Bird Calls. And of course, most importantly, we want to thank you out there who are listening. Without, as mentioned, without sponsors, the show is not possible. But without listeners like you, there's not much point to having a show. So thank you to the listeners as well as the guests and the sponsors.
And without you too, Chris. If you hadn't started this, this wouldn't be happening. So I just want to put that shout out there.
All right. Thanks, Marty.
You're
thank you
welcome.
For bringing that up.
No problem.
And thank you as well. It's just a lot of love here at Bird Calls.
We're just having a great old time.
Yeah, we are. All right. Well, let's bring on Kevin. Are you there, Kevin?
Yes, I am.
All right. Kevin Carlson. So we're going to get into birding by impression and some of your books. You have the Shore Bird Guide. So we want to talk about that, but we started the show talking about some of the early migrants. So you live in Cape May. What's going on down there in terms of birds coming up?
Well, the migrants have been, they never left.
Okay.
they did, some did, but yeah, we basically did not have a winter for the first time in my 59 years on the earth, and literally no snow, which we rarely have much snow anyway, but January and February were mixed in with 60, 70, and even 80-degree days, and some of the lingering warblers and birds that would have perished in a normal winter survived wonderfully. All my clapper rails in my backyard lived through the winter, at least I think they did. Ospreys came through last week and in tremendous numbers, right on schedule. The birds in South America don't know that it's warm up here, so they rely on the clock and, sun and the changes in, unless they're in the tropical equator zone. But they come back on schedule, and they did this year as well. Laughing gulls came back a bit early. Phoebes were here in late February, and typically they would have perished, but they didn't. So all in all, the lack of the winter is was good for birds this year. So
okay,
yeah,
all right.
Red-tail hawks are all displaying, doing their display flights. In fact, they're already on nest, and which is a little bit early, but they're a hardy bird. They don't migrate from here, so we have a pair in a nest almost in view from my office window now, but. It's a beautiful day down here near Cape May, 60 degrees, sunny, a real spring day.
Oh, good.
I like, unlike the 75-degree day we had last week or the week before.
Wish I was there.
Yesterday was we had a little bit of a nor'easter, but
it's okay. You have to have a little bit of that thrown in, right, Kevin?
Yeah, it was fine.
Yeah. So you co-authored the Shorebird Guide. It takes a little bit different, of a guide than your typical field guide. Tell us about that book and a little bit about birding by impression.
Yeah, Chris. I've been a birder. I was a serious, hardcore lister as a birder for about 15 years. My first 15 years, I've been birding since 1978. So I guess that's 34 years. And seriously chasing birds for my first 15 years, which is kind of typical when you first get into birding. It was a little bit competitive, and you wanted to be the best that ever lived, but. I burned out on that after a while. It just it wasn't terribly rewarding. Although this is not a slam on listing, I have many friends still who've been birding longer than me who still list and take it as a sport, and make it fun.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole key. If you're a lister and you don't realize that it's supposed to be a fun sport or hobby or passion or obsession, which birding can be all of those, you kind of lose track of the whole purpose, and it becomes not happy. You don't have fun, and it's almost like an addiction. You get that new bird and or that rare bird, and then when's the next one going to come? And you kind of lose track of the incredible world of birds out there that are not so-called special birds or good birds, and that's what drives my passion these days. Well, for quite a while now, for probably 15 years.
Okay, good.
The common birds are fascinating. All you have to do is take the time to watch them for a while.
That's what I was about to say. Yeah,
not just check them off as a list. I mean, putting a list under your pillow at night for comfort is kind of an empty experience.
So
I try to stress to all the birding participants that take my workshops, and I'll be at Featherfest, starting on, my calendar isn't turned over, April, I believe, a week from this Wednesday, whatever date that is.
Tell us where Featherfest is. Maybe
Featherfest
I'll listen in.
Yeah, it's in Galveston, Texas. It's on the Upper Texas Coast. It's the only bird festival on the Upper Texas Coast, which in the book that I wrote a chapter on, and I'm looking forward, 50 Places to Go Birding Before You Die, put out years ago by Chris Santella, and the publisher is Stuart Tabori and Chang. I was Victor Emmanuel graciously allowed me to write the chapter on the Upper Texas Coast, and I consider it the finest birding destination in the world for diversity of birds in migration, and also in winter, but mostly in migration. It is. It's just staggering, the numbers of shorebirds, gulls, terns, and songbirds when songbirds were abundant, and I don't want to cast a negative slant to the show, but they have declined so much in the last, in my 35 years, and then the old-timers when I started birding, of which I'm an old-timer now, kind of, at 59, but I don't feel 59.
It's all in the mind. It's all in the mind.
Yes, it is, Marty. Yes, yes. And these fellas told me, boy, if you think it was good today, and I'm talking 1978, you should have seen it 20 years ago. Now, when I hit about 1990, that's when I noticed the extreme decline in songbird migration, because I'm in a strong migratory corridor in New Jersey here.
Yeah.
And, the breeding grounds, even more so. I helped with, in fact, this year I'll be back at the Acadia Bird Festival in Maine, starting on May 31st with Pete Dunn. Pete Dunn and I are keynoting and headlining that festival this year, so come on up. And
that should be a fun one.
Yeah, it's a small one. We max out at about 130 to 150 people. We can't really accommodate a whole lot more up near the Acadia National Park, which is where the festival is centered. And songbirds are kind of the focus up there, but I was just stunned last year at how
Few there were. Yeah.
Well, relative to my experience, and you know, let's face it, it's all relative. Those people who just started out, it's fascinating and it's wonderful. And the worst thing to do is burst their bubble and say, well, it's not so good. You know, it used to be good. You don't say that, but or privately. You know, I can say it to you today because it's just a trend of decline in songbirds.
Seen that too, Kevin. I mean, you know, through the years that I've been bird watching, that's the honest fact. But yes, you're right. Yeah. Keep it positive, and certainly there's always great stuff to see out there if you take the time and not tick it off and run off. I mean, those that do, that's fine.
Sure.
But
and you know, you never lose hope. You know, they've declined, and you know, red knots were almost wiped out at the late 1800s, early 1900s when they were collecting the crabs for fertilizer and grinding it up, and you know that was catastrophic. They bounced back, and now they're in peril again, and let's hope they bounce back again with all the new controls we have on harvesting crabs. And you know, the songbirds, it's just you know, you lose, you know, according to some of the migration bulletins I've read, we used to lose 48 roughly percent or 47% of all first year warblers anyway. Historically, so they were balanced on this precipice where they would increase a little bit each year, but it was mostly a stabilization thing with them to when they did reach their peak threshold. But now we've pushed the loss into the 50s, you know, over, so more than half get lost each year and don't make it back to the breeding grounds. And that has slowly, and of course that's the worst type of crisis that we can ever face, one that creeps up on us rather than one like the American kestrel where it's just crashing and we don't know why, but this creeping up stuff is the bad one. But no, you know, I keep a positive outlook because you know, hey, the world changes. There's nothing we can do about it at times, but there is a lot we can do about saving habitat, and we have, you know, American Bird Conservancy, Audubon, plenty of organizations have worked hard, and you know, we can turn things.
Yeah, do a little bit as much as you can.
Sure.
Just a quick question, going back a little bit, you had mentioned about the red knots. And what is the current state of red knots in New Jersey at this time?
Well, they're endangered. We got them on Larry Niles and, of course, Mandy. I'm trying to think of Mandy's last name. I'm embarrassed. But
that's all right, Mandy.
Yeah, she works for the New Jersey Fish and Wildlife Endangered and Non-Game Division. They monitor the red knots every year. They've done incredible studies. They're wonderful special, A Crash, A Tale of Two Species, meaning red knot and horseshoe crab, on PBS several years ago. And if you have a chance to see that, fabulous.
I think most people have, but it's terrific.
Yeah, and last year was one of the best years in 12 years for egg mass and weight gathering.
That's
and why?
Terrific.
Because the moratorium in New Jersey has been in place, and we'll get to birding by impression out there, folks. Don't worry.
Absolutely.
I'm looking at my clock. We have close to 25 minutes. I got on a little late today, but it won't take long. And this is fun stuff anyway. But the knots are, they were averaging 8, 9, 10 grams a day weight gain, and they need to get from the 100 to 125 grams they are when they arrive, to 200 plus grams, or they're not going to make it to the tundra. That overland flight over boreal forest, you know, they'll unfortunately fall out of the sky, and that's it. But they kind of know that, and so if they don't put on the weight, they typically won't, most of them won't make the flight. But they put on incredible amounts of weight in a short period of time, and basically almost the entire group here, which is about 15,000 birds, you know, down from 125,000 in the 90s.
And even more earlier than that, but that's another story for another day.
Yes or no? I'm not so sure. I don't know the historic figures they talk about, but with these crashes, you know, the historic, you know, slaughter, you know, taking of crabs in the early 1900s, I'm sure it set them back quite a bit too, but so back and forth, but they all left by the historical date of like May 25th rather than like June 5th or 10th, like had been the case during the lean years where they couldn't put weight on. So it compromised their time on the tundra, and so, you know, there's hope for, in that respect. And they seem to have stabilized around this 12 to 15,000 number. And also given the fact that we don't have a super accurate count of the numbers wintering in Florida, but they seem to have stabilized on that level, and I'm hoping the biggest problem isn't the numbers here and how much food they get here, it's whether they can find mates up on the tundra.
Because
it's so vast up there, and they just don't, you know, if the males go up and start singing, and you've got thousands and thousands of square miles. You know, the Arctic tundra where I worked 4 years in the 90s up near Prudhoe Bay, you know, we had 178,000 square miles of similar Arctic tundra on the north slope of Alaska, and Red Knot comes from an area that's even bigger. Take 15,000 of them, and that's males and females, spread them out, and, you know, will she hear him singing? That's the problem.
I was actually talking about my mother was a professional photographer, and she was monitoring and photographing the Red Knots back in the early 40s and 50s. So in Cape May at Reed's Beach, but we get another time.
Yeah, you know, without aerial surveys, there's no way you were going to get an accurate count. And they, you know, Clay Sutton, Jim Dowdell,
sure,
a few others did that during the 80s.
Yeah.
When the crisis was starting to become evident. But no, there's hopes for Red Knots. I'm definitely not taking a downward tone on those. I feel that with the protections we have in place and the crab numbers coming up, they're resilient creatures, and they live a long time. You know, you could do 20, 25 years for a Red Knot. So they have the ability to hang in there, and, I got hope for them.
Let's hope that trend continues where they,
come down to Feather Fest and visit. I'll be leading some trips. I'm doing a big day van on Saturday. We go to Bolivar Flats, in my opinion, one of the best places in the world to bird. And I guess that starts around April. If I flip my calendar, I'll see. April 11, 12, I'm sorry, 12 through the 15th. But let's get back to the Shorebird Guy because I see my clock is starting to dwindle down here.
Okay. How does one move beyond seeing a mixed flock of shorebirds and saying, oh, look at all those shorebirds or peeps, to saying, oh, look at those semi-palmated sandpipers and sanderlings and that? So how do you pin them down?
Well, you know, experts have always been able to pin them down, you know, by sheer repetition, by studying their field guides, by looking at details. But, I was pretty much an analytical birder, meaning I looked at feathers, I looked at details. I did not, in my first 25 years of birding, roughly that, did not even bring into consideration evaluating the structural, the shape, the body shape, and the structural features of any bird I saw, other than like an unconscious, okay, that's, you know, bigger than a bread box, smaller than a cat, you know, smaller than a robin, bigger than a robin, that type of comparative sizing. But I never carefully evaluated structural features compared them to other similar birds or not similar birds and used that as an important part of my ID process. You know, in fact, almost all traditional field guides negate or minimize the importance of looking at structural features. What do I mean by that? How long is the bill? How thick is the bill? What's the shape of the bill? How long are the legs? All right, some details need to come into play there. Okay, well, what's short, what's long? Mm-hmm. So we, you know, in the new book, which we didn't mention yet, there's a new book of mine and my wife, Dale Rosselette, co-author for the Roger Torrey Peterson Reference Series at Houghton Mifflin. You know, the famous, it's kind of an offshoot of the old Roger Torrey Peterson field guides. These are specialty series guides. The first one was The Gulls book by Steve Howell and John Dunn. And Steve Howell just did a wonderful book on malt.
Yeah.
And I just spoke to Rick Wright the other night. He was actually going to do the sparrows, a book on sparrows in the reference guide out in 2014. Free plug, Rick.
Oh, man, that's going to be a cool one.
What I'm doing with the Birding by Impression book is I'm going to try to share with people the value and the importance and the absolute logical approach to using, and I'm going to switch gears a little here, a right brain skill or a right brain function of evaluating shapes and forms as such, not analyzing them, not putting them in an ABC linear order, because, you know, evaluation in a right brain sense is nonlinear. What does nonlinear mean? It doesn't have a beginning, it doesn't have an end, it just is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at it, you evaluate it, there wasn't a start to that process. It's kind of a holistic process of just absorbing certain features. But, and like I was saying before, I will qualify. What's a short bill? One that's less than half the width of the head. What's a medium-sized bill? About the width of a head. A long bill, 1.5 to 2, extra long, 3 or more. So, all right, you're done there. And now we can say, okay, it's a short bill, a long bill. Common sense-wise, you can kind of say that. But let's face it, a beginner doesn't have that, the benefit of being familiar with what's short, what's long. You know, if you look at a 2-inch bill for your whole life and then see a 3-inch one, wow, that's a long bill.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, we've got 12, 14-inch bills on long bill curlews and, you know, inch long or less, you know, half-inch long bills on some plovers, little stubby bills. So evaluating these features builds a foundation for your ID, whether you're a beginner, an intermediate bird, or an expert. But I have more luck with beginners grasping and absorbing and putting to use a birding by impression approach. And I coined that word, by the way. I didn't invent this process of ID. In fact, Roger Peterson, who everybody puts forth as the birder who only looked at details, because he had points and arrows to the wing bars, to the supercilium. Well, Pete Dunn showed me an article by Roger early in the 50s where he said, the most important things you can initially do when you look at a bird is note its size and its shape. You know, this was Roger. He was not, you know, but he understood that in order to educate the birders in America who were just kind of getting into this hobby, you better do an analytical approach. You better do a linear approach so it makes sense and so they can have a foundation. My feeling is the foundation, I was a builder, a carpenter, and I wouldn't think of, you know, starting to trim my windows before I put the foundation in to hold up the house.
Yeah.
So my feeling is when you look at a bird, if you note its general size, is it bigger than a robin, smaller than a robin? Use anything in your life, even if it's a single bird out there. Visualize, as a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer did once, I showed her a small sandpiper and said, well, how big is that? She said, I'm not a birder, I can't do that. I said, think of something in your life. And she said, well, it's about as long as a stick of butter.
Okay.
She was looking at a semi-palmated sandpiper, which is 5.5 to 5.75 long. Well, I measured a stick of butter, 5.5.
Yeah.
Wow,
she hit it right on the head. So some of this is intuitive. So if you note the size of a bird, the shape of its body, is it round? Is it chunky? Is it slender? Is it tapered or elongated? You know, these are common sense things.
Mm-hmm.
Then you say, okay, the leg's long, okay. Is the bill long? Is it thin or is it thick? Or is it down-curved or is it up-curved? You know, all these things become intuitive after a short amount of time. And eventually, a la Malcolm Gladwell's book Blink, where you can thin slice something literally in the blink of an eye, if you're evaluating impressions, and that's why I call these, I will interchange the word features with impressions, because impressions, people might get drawn into the connotation that an impression is ethereal, you know, but a feature is something that's concrete. But, you know, in my opinion, it's a personal thing when you evaluate a feature. You know, Marty might say, well, that's a skinny one. And I'll say, well, I don't think it's so skinny, Marty. I think it's kind of thick. And are we wrong, either of us? No.
No.
Because it's a personal impression that you will carry with you the next time you see that same bird, and it will benefit you then. So rather than you making mistakes in the classical ornithological sense of the word by trying to put forth details that don't correspond with the literal translation in your field guide, when you evaluate a bird for the first time or for the 100th time, you're pretty much, and believe me, I'm still studying American robins 5 years later in my yard. I love American robins. And, you know, I'll pick up something new. Your brain basically needs to have a foundation before it can take itself to the next level in evaluative skills.
Mm.
And this is what people don't realize. And they say, well, I've had people, when I published articles on birding by impression in Birding Magazine and Living Bird and Wild Bird and a few others, write in and just say, hey, a duck is a duck. If a duck is a duck, it's a duck. If it looks like a duck, quacks like, you know, and I'm like, that's such a simplistic error on your part, because that is true, but your intuitive recognition and your eventual ability to just pass a glance at something the way you see super birders do and come up with an ID that's right on comes from a repetitive conscious evaluation of birds. You don't just identify them once and then check them off every time you see them and say, what's the next new one? You know, you watch them for a while, and you'll be surprised. As a photographer, I'll spend hours at times with one bird. And rather than just wonder, you know, keep striving to get the best shot, use your time to watch it move. Eventually, that movement is going to bypass your cognitive brain. This is Malcolm Gladwell's language, again, from Blink, and go to what Gladwell calls the great computer behind the brain, and you will store the impression of this creature so that eventually, when you just give it a passing glance, there may be something that triggers a little switch in your brain where you will actually recognize the movement.
Yeah.
Combined with the shape, combined with the head shape, combined with the bill, combined with the leg length, bill length, and primary projection, or the wing, or how tapered or stocky, all in a two-second period of time.
All right.
And it can be done. And so, analogy for those out there that are kind of saying, well, I don't think that can be done. Did you ever see your brother or sister or mother a block away and watch them move and not have to analyze them or not have to do anything to recognize them, see any features, details, or anything?
You just know it's them.
Yeah, you know it's them. How do you know it's them? You just know. Based on repetitive viewing and this intuitive recognition of their now familiar movements.
So, right, all the way back from the beginning of that intuitive.
All the way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, these familiar movements, they're familiar because unconsciously you've absorbed them. But not my feeling, because I was a perfect candidate for birding by impression. I was analytical. I'm left-brained by nature. I was able to switch gears thanks to Michael O'Brien and Richard Crossley, who were my co-authors, who introduced me to what I call a different approach to birding. Richard has said, oh, it's not different, or it's not new. And I said, but it's new to me. So it's like, well, it is new and it is different. It's different if it's something that's new. So it just evolved. It took me about a year to switch gears to kind of evaluate birds rather than analyze them. But once I did, the sky's the limit. Because now you're using a combination of right brain skills and left brain skills to come to your ID. You've set a foundation with things that are not going to change during the year, like a bird's plumage, which will change four times, you know, into breeding, out of breeding, breeding, and non-breeding. And you're just going to see a shape. And so a lot of workshops I do, I like to tell people, I don't want to hear anything about a detail on what I show you, but tell me about what you're seeing on the screen. And they'll say, well, it's red. I'll say, well, there's a detail. Give me the shape. Give me the form. And so it's a process that isn't magical. It isn't instantaneous, but it's fun because you don't need a book to tell you how to do it. Mm-hmm. You're pretty much, you know, walking this path by yourself.
Right. And like myself, I would never, you know, you can take a picture and move along. You can tick off a bird, which for those who do, it's great. I have no thing, but I can't do it. I have to sit there and watch what they're doing, whether it's a shorebird, a songbird, any kind of bird. I want to see its behavior. I want to see what's going on and what makes this thing tick at that time.
Yeah, you know, that's fun, and you know, it's all your personal preference, but, you know, again, for those listeners out here who said, Carlson's not on our side, I'm leading a big day van at Featherfest on my choosing, where we will chase all day long and see as many species as we can for the fun of it.
Right, I'm sure for those beginners, you'll separate the dowagers in the field and how you can do that.
Quickly, I told people we're not going to make it a workshop. But anyway, this new book is going to be in the Houghton Mifflin Company, and I think it's Houghton Mifflin Harcourt now.
Yeah.
And when is it going to be out? I'm not sure. And my wonderful editor, Lisa White, who is the best editor that ever lived, and I hope she's listening or will listen, because she has been so patient with me. I'm in the third rewrite of this book. She's thrown it back at me twice, much to my dismay and argument. I argued with her and argued with her. She held her ground and said, look, Kevin, I know you're the expert, but if I can't understand it, who is going to out there? And what is your audience?
Right, and that editor is on your side, Kevin.
Yes, yes. You know, some editors aren't as knowledgeable as Lisa or as aware that, you know, they'll just let you put out whatever you put out.
Yes.
You're the expert. It must be right. Well, Lisa has pushed me, and we are so close. And I'm within about 2 weeks of finishing the text. And the photographs are going to be different, and I'm glad, you know, I'm looking at the clock, and we're running low on time already. And I just started. I guess we shouldn't have drifted so much at the beginning.
I know.
That's all right. We're not going to take a break.
We're just going to
keep cruising.
Yeah.
We're almost close. But anyway, this book will contain about 150 of what I call comparative photo arrays that have never been used in the ID process. They will be... You know, Sibley did an incredible job, and David told us several years ago during one of his talks in Cape May where he used to live, and David lived in my house for 3 years when he was a struggling artist in the 80s. Can you imagine that?
Mm-hmm.
And I used to see his work all around. But he painted his birds in his book, if you've never noticed, the same relaxed posture facing the same direction without disparate body structure. Because let's face it, a bird with its neck up versus a bird with its head down is going to look different.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I chose to put together, I'll take an example, Arctic tern, common tern, and roseate tern, all somewhat similarly shaped birds and very similar plumaged birds in non-breeding plumage in the same relaxed posture, and I will digitize them size to scale in the same photo facing the same direction in the same relaxed posture. You would be amazed, and you will be amazed, when this book comes out, when you look at these photos, and without prompting, pick out three or four structural differences, whether it be head shape, bill shape, body shape, wing length, tapered versus stocky, steep forehead versus shallow forehead. You'll pick that stuff out without me telling you. And in fact, many of these photo arrays, I'm not going to tell you which is which. I'm going to make you go to the appendix so that you'll look at it, you'll pick out the differences, you go to the appendix and say, wow, I got 6 out of 7. But I learned so much from putting these photo arrays together on species that I thought I knew just because you had them side by side on the same page. If you put a bird on one page and a bird on another, when you flip that page, you lose all your mental connection, your visual connection to what you were just looking at, because it's not linear. It's in the present, and you're evaluating it. When you turn the page, you got a blank slate to start with again visually. You may remember a detail here or there. Well, I remember it had a flatter crown, but let me go back and check is what you'll always do.
Yeah.
These photos will allow you to look at these incredibly similar species, the dowitchers, the two willets, you know, western and semi-sandpiper, western tropical kingbird, and couch's kingbird, where you can possibly do about 50% of them in the field, whereas probably 9 out of 10, 99 out of 100 birders, no, you can't.
Yeah.
Well, yes, you can, not by plumage, by structure. So this book will have these photos laid out like that, and I think it's, and Pete Dunn as well, this is the evolution of birding.
Huh.
Okay.
We can't overanalyze anything anymore and learn anything new about, you know, wing bars, plumage, supercilium, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, we've taken that to the limit. We used that up 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now we need to go to the next level and evaluate the shape, the form, and put in that very important thing, thanks to technology and Photoshop, and I'm pretty good in Photoshop, digital technology that allows us to effectively compare side-by-side these similar species so that when we go out in the field and only see one of them, we'll have a mental image of that in our head. Again, Gladwell.
Okay.
The impression will be stored, and so that when you see it, it will set off a little switch and it will say, this is the slot, not that slot. You know, if it's one out of two, one out of three, it's going to fall into that slot without your permission. And when that happens, it's a wonderful experience in the field when suddenly, intuitively, you recognize this. And, you know, I notice we're just about out of time. I want to tell people my email. Am I allowed to give my email out?
Yeah, sure.
Sure, absolutely.
And give your website, too, if you want.
Yeah, Carlson3, K-A-R-L-S-O-N, the number 3, at Comcast.net. And if you have a problem finding that or remembering that, go to Google and just put in Kevin Carlson Photography. It'll send you to my website. Click, put the cursor on my name. My information will come up. Why I'm saying this, I'm doing an e-book. It should be done by the summer on Shorebird ID. And as one of the authors of the Shorebird Guide, you know, I consider myself one of the experts in the country. And this e-book will give you numerous photos not in the Shorebird Guide, unbelievable personal information and tips of mine for $20.
Well, you're going to have to come back on and tell us about that another time. And
yes.
You're going to have to come back.
Let me just tell them, Marty, before you leave, send me your email, and I will give you. I will let you know when it's going to be available and how to pay for it. So that's, and I think you'll love this e-book, and I'm doing it in response to numerous workshop participants that have asked me, please, please, we want this information somewhere. So we have so much more to talk about, but we're out of time.
We do, so we'll have to do part 2 and part 3, right, Kevin?
We definitely do.
Yes, yes. We didn't get into my tours that I'll be leading. Oh, by the way, Thailand, Spoonbill Sandpiper Tour, Sunrise Birding next January. I'll be the tour leader. Only 8 people can go. Sunrise Birding.
Okay.
All right. Well, we'll definitely have you back, Kevin.
Great.
And thanks for sharing your insight on the birding by impression. We look forward to that book coming out.
I gave you guys a lot of time to ask a lot of questions, didn't I? You know, Marty and I have had a million conversations recently, and usually we split the time talking.
Yeah.
Yes, I know.
This was 9 out of 10 my voice, but you know what? It's my time.
It's That's your right. time. Absolutely. You know,
are tuning in to
you are the guest.
All right, guys. Hey, listen, thanks so much, and I'll be putting this on my Facebook site, and it's being rebroadcast tomorrow night, right?
Yes, it is, from 8 to 9.
Yeah, and the archive, therefore, will be on birdcallsradio.com.
And it'll be out worldwide, so great. Anybody can listen to it streaming.
All right.
Thanks,
all
Kevin.
Right.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
So that was Kevin Carlson, a renowned photographer and author and advocate of birding by impression. And thank you, everybody, for tuning into Bird Calls. Thank you, Marty. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
I want to just quickly jump in and say that the rerun is going to be from 9 to 10 tomorrow night.
9 to 10.
Okay.
Yes. Oh, okay. Yes. Correction.
All right.
There.
So that's okay. Good to know. 9 to 10. All right. Thanks, everybody. 1490 WGCH.